Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Novelist Meg Wolitzer has written several popular novels, including The Wife, The 10-Year Nap, and The Uncoupling. Her new novel is an exploration of friendship, coming of age, talent, and success. The Interestings follows six artistic friends who meet as teenagers one pivotal summer at a camp called Spirit in the Woods. The story follows their lives over the next 40 years through college, marriage, children, through success, disappointment, and unmet expectations. It is a great pleasure to welcome Meg Wolitzer back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And congratulations on a wonderful new novel.
Thanks a lot.
At what point did you know that you wanted to tackle something big and to tackle something over many decades?
Well, when I came up with the idea, which was to study talent over time and look at various related issues like envy, I knew that I would start it in the summer of 1974, which was, in fact, a very pivotal summer for me when I was a teenager. But it wasn't going to be a teenage novel, and it wasn't going to be a novel that stayed in that summer. So the more I wrote, I realized, when you write a long novel, you have to kind of give it breathing room.
And what kind of breathing room did you want to give it?
Well, I wanted to show how these characters develop. I wanted to show how their whole lives unfold. And when you do that, you know, you're really kind of going into uncharted territory. You're moving ahead into the future, and you're not just sort of stopping after that summer the way a lot of novels do.
I do want to talk specifically about the novel, but I do have to ask about the essay that you wrote in the New York Times about The Second Shelf, entitled The Second Shelf, on the rules of literary fiction for men and women. And this book in many ways seems an answer to that. And I assume, since that was written about a year ago, that you were very much involved in this novel when those thoughts came to you, as you said, let's get that out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I wrote that essay in the book review, I had been thinking about these issues for years and years. I guess I wasn't really ready to write it, to sort of put it down into words. So while I was writing about differences that I had seen in the way fiction by women and men is treated in this country and the way books are made to look and the way people think about books by men and women, I'm in the middle of writing this book. And I'm trying to just write the book I want to write, not to be affected by anything, but really write the book I want to write. And I think that's always, at least for me, kind of an ongoing process. It's kind of like prying open a really difficult can, because you want to be more of yourself. You want to be free of some of the things that you might see as inhibitors.
When you talk about inhibitors, because much of what you write about in that essay, which is amazing, is that it seems as though a lot of this has to do with marketing and ultimately the respect that the author is given for the work that they have done.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I noticed, I went around and looked at books, and I kind of noticed that there was really a difference between the way quite a few books by women looked compared with books by men, that women's literary fiction, I mean, I hate using that term. I don't want to break up the big world of fiction, but let's just call it literature by women and literature by men, books that I care about. Some of the ones by women had a kind of dreamy, unfocused quality to the cover with a more figurative cover. The lettering might be smaller. And some books by men that were commensurate in terms of how, you know, the kind of review respect that people gave them had a sort of bolder cover. And I thought that these were messages that were being given to readers. And what were the messages that the books, you know, a publicist said to me, which I quoted in the piece, some books that have big, bold lettering and just typeface covers, what they say to the reader is this book is an event. And covers that look like a beautiful pastel say, ooh, this is something aesthetic and something dreamy that you might want to sort of spend time with. And I think that that is meant really to appeal more to women. So what happens is there's a whole trajectory, I think, that a book undergoes. You know, from books are passed from hand to hand. There's recommendations. When book review editors decide what they're going to review, they look at the thing as an object. When it comes in as a what's called a galley, they look at this thing with big bold lettering, or they look at a thing with a little girl in a field of wheat, and they do come to conclusions, and some of the conclusions are wrong.
And you talk in this in the piece about talking to someone at a party, and they ask you what you do, and you say that you're a writer and anything that I would know of, and ultimately you end up talking to the person's wife, but you say what I heard of you, the question that you were asked, that you were tempted to say, well, in a more just world.
Yes, that happened to me. And sure, I mean, because I think what happened in that conversation and what's happened in other conversations is that there's this idea that a novel that's about women's interior lives, women's lives, or even mothers and children, or women friends, or mothers and daughters, or women and men, is sort of something for women more than for men. And how can that be? I mean, look, it's... I want to sort of say that there are, you know, there are quite a number of men who read novels by women and about women and don't feel sort of scared off by any of that. And in fact, love it. I mean, I've heard from them and they feel underrepresented, you know, in things I've said and the way it's been portrayed. But primarily, and you see this in film as well, of course, this is a problem in the culture, men and women both will sort of venture off into stories that are about men. And it's harder to get men en masse to read stories or see stories about women.
So when you look at this new book, because you write in that piece about cover art and so forth. So you look at the new book, The Interestings, and it seems as though you got what you wanted.
I did, actually, very much. My publisher, Riverhead, was very respectful of what I wanted, and the art department was very sensitive to that. I wanted, but look, it's not like I wanted a cover with like black lettering and a door, you know, like a military cover. I did not want that, but I wanted a cover that said, that was aesthetic, first of all. I mean, you know, it's not like covers by men, we want them to be ugly and sort of just blocky. You want a book to feel like something you want to go into, but I don't want it to somehow send a coded message saying, oh, this is for women and we all know that. So it's a very beautiful painting. It looks almost like a Mark Rothko painting.
It does, and very Rothko-esque.
It's got big letters. You know, my name is so big it embarrassed me. I don't know what my name means to people, but it looks good in big capital letters. I don't know. I mean, you want to feel when you read any book that this is an exciting thing that is worth spending your time on. You know, our lives are so oversubscribed. We are on the internet all day. When you read a book, books can become luxury items, I'm afraid. And you really want to feel this is worth your time. And messages of how covers look, you know, are sent to readers.
Also, and you make this point, the size of the book. This is a substantial novel where many others are slight and are thin and sort of rejected just for their size.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of hard to look at that and understand it exactly. I wrote a novel called The Wife, which people, you know, it's perhaps my most well-known of my novels, and it's very short. But it's very intense and funny, and it's a first-person narrative. And I think it was like, you know, 200-something pages. It needed to be that length because it would have exhausted the reader and the writer if it had been too much longer than that. I think that content does seek form. And when you're writing about a group of people and you're following them over time, it's ambitious and you need to let it have its length. So I decided not to worry about that. But yes, there is that quality too. You know, you see a novel by William T. Vollman and it's, you know, like 1,000 pages, or you see Infinite Jest and it's 1,000 pages. And either you go, I really want to be in that world and this guy's a genius, or I don't have the time, or why does it need that much time? There are novels that didn't need the space that they took up. You know, it really depends on the book. But I allowed myself, I think, more freedom to not worry this time.
And I want to talk a little bit about that freedom, because is that conscious in the sense of saying, is it a different process because you're going to allow yourself time and ultimately not even in the writing, but of the thinking about the book, that is fundamentally different.
You know, writing novels as long as I have been, which is 30 years, I think constantly about the process of what it means to write a novel. And it's truly a work in progress for me. So that I think I'm still on this evolutionary path, as all writers are. And what I want from a novel, from myself, keeps changing. Now that I've written this book, I'm thinking, well, what do I want from a novel next time? What will it be? I loved thinking in a more expansive way this time. I really enjoyed it. I really, really liked it. It was sort of like sleeping in a king-size bed in my brain.
One of the things that struck me immediately in reading the book was the fact that there was a substantial cast of characters and that you had opened yourself up to a much larger world then. And I'm all for that. I find that to be fun to follow these people for an extended length of time.
I had a pretty big cast of characters in my novel, The 10-Year Nap. And also in my novel, The Position, I had four children in a family and their two parents. But what was different here is that I let them go from age 15 to age 53. And essentially, they felt like the same people to me, you know, regardless of their age. But something does happen when you include more of the world in a book. I mean, I definitely included things that happened in the world, some cultural moments in the book. I allowed those in a way that was different from what I'd done in the past. But partly it was really because it seemed required for this book. The book is about so much that you lose over time. And I put a lot of things in it that were gone, like Pan Am and, the names of, you know, Watergate is something that we thought about all the time in the summer of 1974 when this book begins. And now it's just amazingly faded when it was so vivid and so, so shocking. So there were some moments that I really, really did need to refer to. And then it brought the world in a new way.
There seems to be an urgency maybe to this book that I hadn't seen in the book. Is that fair?
I'm glad to hear you feel that way. I definitely felt it writing it. I couldn't wait to get back to it when I was working on it. I felt a kind of breathlessness about it. Like I really wanted to get it down. And my editor and I were talking about it and, you know, it was sort of like a lot of it was preformed in my mind. I'd been thinking about these ideas. You marinate, you know, ideas marinate for a very long time before you get them down. But so much thought has been put into them that it's almost like it's not even a first draft when you're writing it.
We're talking to Meg Wolitzer. The name of the new novel is The Interestings, and it is published by Riverhead. So much as we were talking about how we perceive a book to be a big book, that this is an event, that's sort of how this came out then, that this was a big book.
Well, you never know in advance, and you can't think about it for your own book. You know, I was studying that as a phenomenon when I was writing the essay, but, you know, it's really sort of sad if you look at books that you have lying around, or galleys, more to the point, of books that came out, say, in the 1990s, you know, first printing, 50,000 copies, and you never heard of it, and it was meant to be something big,
right.
And it didn't become something big because the world doesn't treat your work the way you have the fantasy it will. You know, sometimes it does, mostly it doesn't. You can't focus on that. I've been happy with how things have gone so far, but I'm just moving forward. I'm a working writer.
When we talk about the I mentioned that sense of urgency, but what I was impressed by is that nowhere in there is there lost. The beauty is not lost in the writing, that is allowed to establish. So again, there's almost that freedom to think about, for you as the writer, to think about the overall story, but also on the language and the actual construction?
When I started writing, I was very, very focused, very deliberately on language. You know, the writing classes that I took in college were very craft-based. And I cared more about style and sentences than anything. I cared about it much more than I did the overarching structure. So when I became a novelist, my senior year in college, I sold my first novel. I think it's a language-based novel that succeeds in a micro way and is emotional. But I didn't even think about what is a novel? What is the project of a novel? And now, you know, you're right. I haven't lost my love of the sentence. I think that a novel that in which, you know, style doesn't figure, I can't imagine wanting to read that, because a novel is a collection of sentences and a collection of words. So I care about that very deeply. But you have to sort of keep your eye on both things, the short and the long view of it.
As you mentioned in the beginning, and it becomes very clear in the novel that one of the themes that you want to address is talent. And what brought you to that point?
Talent is something that is described in the book as a slippery thing, because if you have it when you're young, there's this idea, perhaps, that you have or the adults around you have, that it's going to last and that it's going to propel you through life. And, you know, I was very influenced by the Michael Apted films, 7 Up, 28 Up. I don't know if you've seen them. Mm. The British documentarian who followed a group of British school children every 7 years, filming them to see what their lives became. It's both hopeful and sad the way lives are. And looking at talent and how it sort of manifests itself, if you think about the most talented people you knew when you were growing up, what became of them? Is it shocking that certain of them fell away? Did they use that talent that you thought was so big in some other way? I thought that talent is something that we just so fetishize in our society, you know, prodigies or the one who's the best at everything. But if you're not deeply talented, as one of the characters in the book says, you know, what are people supposed to do? Kill themselves? I mean, what is the idea of talent? What is its point? And, I really realized that I was incredibly interested in this.
And as you said, this comes from a pivotal summer that you had. This is a summer camp for the arts.
Yes.
So you're looking at kids who have some inclination in that regard. And so there's pressure just at the beginning, at the base level, isn't there?
There was pressure. One thing that was interesting to me that summer, it was the first time I'd ever sort of taken myself seriously. It was very freeing. I guess in a way it was the opposite of pressure. Now that I think about it, we weren't self-conscious yet. I mean, we were pretentious, of course, but putting on those plays like, you know, six characters in search of an author, not the usual Oklahoma, it wasn't that kind of camp. I was just sort of able to explore something that hadn't been brought out in me and to feel anything was possible. It's only later that you start to feel disappointments and put pressures on yourself and think, how can I turn this into something? But that summer, no, it was very pure.
And what about the outside expectations? In the sense of sending you to this camp in the hope that...
I don't know that there were any yet, I have to say.
Not even for you, but your family. And...
Well, you know, I'd always been sent to these camps where the summer before, a kid had gotten his leg shot at a terrible camp that immediately closed. And we were the ones, I wasn't allowed to do riflery, which was fine with me. And I sat writing in a journal when everybody else was doing riflery. And there was apparently it was sort of poorly managed. So almost as a response to that, I went off to this uber arts camp. And I'd always been in the plays in school and the editor of the literary magazine, so it just sort of made sense. But the kids I met there were much more sophisticated than I was. They were from New York City. I was from the suburbs. They knew things about the world. They weren't sophisticated in a jaded way. They were sensitive and they were, I hate to say it, but they were intellectual.
And as you point in the novel, that creativity that is so rewarded at a young age has an expiration date, or can have an expiration date. And for that person and for their friends and how they're perceived, that has a huge impact.
Well, you know, we joke sometimes, and there's this line in the book, really, about the notion of parents who really want their kids to get into a glass-blowing class when they're young. They would feel upset if their child became a glassblower as an adult. Those same parents, some of them. But why? Because you want your child to be filled with all kinds of possibilities. But then later, a lot of people want them to kind of get with the program and have a life that feels like it's a stable life. I mean, I have children who I was walking down the street once with my son when he was five, and he saw a sign in a McDonald's and it said now hiring. And he said, look, Mom, look. He thought that was a stable life that I could have instead of being a writer. You know, and of course I took him up on it, and I've been working at the at the fry table. I just think it's hard living as an artist. It's hard having that kind of a life. And parents worry about their children. My children are welcome to become glassblowers. I just believe, you know, the whole idea of passion, we do also focus on that in this society. But it's true that if you don't love things, whatever they are, glassblowing, being in plays, getting something sparked in you as a child, I think it's harder to get things sparked in you later, but it can happen.
And so let's look at you for a moment, of your maturation as a writer and what we could have taken from that arts camp to what we see now, that I assume that there was the, we see your work and it is very good, and now we look and we say we see your work and it's very good, but there's a long road in between.
Yeah, I mean, well, because I was doing acting and I wasn't good, I was sort of funny, but in a kind of, I was awkward and maybe too loud and then too quiet. And I could compare myself with certain kids there who were amazing and who I really thought would become Katharine Hepburn. I saw the way they could interpret lines, and I didn't have that ability. But I took everything in and had already, you know, was writing quite a bit at that teenage point, and went back, and the stuff that I got there, the feeling that I got for collaborative work, which is, you know, you miss that when you're writing by yourself. When you're just writing, you don't have collaboration. The collaborative work was wonderful and less lonely. And then there's the quiet period where you're going to college and you're just thinking a lot. And then you publish and it gets louder. And then there's long periods where you're just raising a family plus writing and teaching or whatever you're doing. And, you know, I just sort of see it as kind of like a, you know, as I said, a working writer. But it's not all that shocking, I think, to people who knew me when I was young that I became a writer.
You look at the characters in this novel that you follow that all could sort of be deemed a success, though.
Well, it depends because, you know, my main character, Jules Jacobson, she wanted to be an actress and she becomes a social worker, a clinical social worker, a therapist. And she always thinks about what it would have been like if her life had been bigger. And her best friends are this couple who she met at the camp. They weren't a couple then. And they are phenomenally successful and phenomenally rich. And I think the idea that I realized is that if she didn't know them, her life would be acceptable and she would be able to think of herself as a success. But it's only in relation to them that it's hard to do that. And that's an insidious thing that happens to a lot of people.
When you touched on this a moment ago, but now that this book is complete, do you have an idea of what type of project and what type of issues you want to tackle next?
Somewhat. I've been talking about it with my editor and thinking about it a lot. I don't want to think about my writing life, you know, as being like a biography, like then she wrote this next. You shouldn't be canny with your own writing life. It's not about the career. It's about the work. So I will say, though, that I enjoyed the expansiveness of this book. I wouldn't mind doing that again.
The new novel is The Interestings. It is published by Riverhead. Meg Wolitzer, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's a real pleasure having you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. The show was recorded at the Radio Foundation in New York City. My thanks to their team. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.